Ekhatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekhatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are strapping in for, well, a bit of a crash course in some really timeless wisdom. We're looking at a book that pretty much established the rule book for living well, Aristotle's The Nicomachean Ethics.
Yeah, and this isn't just some dusty old text. It's this incredibly ambitious investigation that really kicked off systematic ethical thinking, you know, over 2,000 years ago.
Right.
And the central question Aristotle gets into is something every single one of us still grapples with today. How should human beings live? And maybe more deeply, what is the ultimate purpose? The telos, he called it, of our existence.
I find this dive, well, particularly crucial right now. I mean, we live in an age that often seems to equate happiness with just, you know, immediate pleasure or getting likes online or how much money you have. And Aristotle just comes along and completely flips that script. So we're going to unpack his argument that the real goal isn't that fleeting stuff, but achieving eudaimonia. That's what we usually translate as like true human flourishing.
That word flourishing is so key. This book gives you a systematic, structured way to think about building a meaningful life. And it's based not on luck or, you know, what happens to you, but on intentional choices and actually developing your character. It's almost like an operating manual for living with purpose.
Okay, so let's talk about the man who wrote this manual.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about Aristotle. What gave him the kind of authority to try and codify human behavior?
Well, Aristotle lived 384 to 322 BCE. He's absolutely one of the foundational figures of Western thought. He spent at this 20 years studying under Plato at the Academy. So he absorbed all the high-level theoretical stuff of his time. Yeah. Then he went off and founded his own school, the Lyceum, in Athens. And probably famously, he tutored Alexander the Great. That must have given him some pretty deep insights into leadership, governance, real-world stuff.
So he had the theory from Plato, but also that practical, real-world angle from observing, well, one of history's biggest figures. That's a powerful combination. But if he was Plato's student, how did his view on ethics change?
Yeah, that's what's so interesting, how he pivoted. You know, Plato often dealt in these really abstract ideals, these forms, arguing for some perfect moral realm out there. Aristotle was different. He was much more empirical, more practical.
Okay.
He grounded his ethics not in some abstract good, but in like careful, systematic observation of how successful, flourishing people actually lived and behaved,
right,
you know, within their communities.
So he was pulling together common sense, watching people, and applying logic. He was basically the first person to treat ethics as its own distinct field, giving us the foundations for how we even talk about moral philosophy today.
Exactly right. He organized it.
Okay, so the book itself, The Nicomachean Ethics, which you mentioned might have been lecture notes maybe compiled by or for his son Nicomachus.
That's a tradition, yeah.
It lays out this structured path.
Mm-hmm.
What's the big overarching idea we need to keep in mind as we go through this?
The main thing, the guiding idea, is that human flourishing, that eudaimonia, is achieved through the excellent lifelong activity of the soul. And crucially, guided fully by reason. This flourishing, it's the ultimate goal of everything we do. We want it just for its own sake. It's really a pursuit of excellence, not just, you know, sitting back and feeling good.
It sounds like it's written for people who are genuinely serious about self-improvement, not just like philosophical debating points.
I think so. The way the text progresses so methodically suggests it was probably aimed at mature individuals, people who already had some life experience, you know, who could connect these concepts to actual life. The book moves really systematically from defining the ultimate good to then dissecting the specific traits and skills you actually need to get there.
And those building blocks for flourishing, they break down into a few key areas.
Yes. He looks at happiness using his function argument. We'll get into that. Then there's the difference between moral virtues like honesty or courage and intellectual virtues like wisdom.
Okay.
Then how we actually acquire virtues. That's the famous doctrine of the mean. Plus the vital skill of practical wisdom or phronesis. And finally, the absolutely essential role of relationships, especially friendship, philia.
All right. Let's start at the beginning then. Wicks 1 and 2. Got to know the destination before we start the journey, right? So tell us about this function argument.
It's actually brilliant in its simplicity. Aristotle basically asks, what's the unique function of a human being? Just like, you know, the good of a flute player is playing the flute well.
Right.
The human good must be performing the distinctly human function excellently. And what really sets us apart from plants and animals It's our capacity for rational activity, thinking, reasoning.
So human excellence means using our reason excellently. It's about kind of optimizing our unique human operating system.
Precisely. So if we know the goal is developing these excellent traits, the next big question is, how do we actually get them? And book two gives the answer. It's through habituation.
This is maybe the most practical and honestly persistent idea from the whole book, isn't it? Mm. It connects ethics directly to just our daily lives. Aristotle says moral virtues aren't really taught in a classroom sense. They're acquired through practice, through habit.
Exactly. You become courageous by doing courageous things repeatedly until that way of acting becomes stable, part of your character.
It makes moral life feel more like learning a skill, like playing an instrument or a sport.
Absolutely. You don't learn generosity just by reading about it. You become generous by actually repeatedly giving. And this leads straight into his famous sort of measuring tool, the doctrine of the mean.
The gold is mean. Virtue is the right midpoint between two extremes, a vice of having too little and a vice of having too much. Like courage being the mean between cowardice, the deficiency, and recklessness, the excess.
Right. It gives you a framework, a way to think about navigating moral choices.
But let me just push back a bit here. Isn't the doctrine of the mean just telling us to be, average? If virtue is always in the middle, how is that excellent or revolutionary?
That's a really common question and a good one. But the mean isn't average in the sense of mediocre. Aristotle is very clear. It's the mean relative to us and relative to the situation.
Uh-huh.
It's the appropriate feeling or action for the circumstances. And figuring that out requires intense discernment. You know, giving $10 might be stingy if you're giving it to a billionaire, but it might be appropriately generous if you're giving it to someone starving. So the mean itself, finding that sweet spot, is actually an extreme of excellence. It's hard to hit.
Okay, that makes more sense. And that discernment, that judgment, becomes really crucial when we talk about responsibility and justice, which you said takes us to books 3, 5, and 6, starting with voluntary action in book 3.
Yeah, Aristotle first establishes the baseline for when we can even hold someone morally responsible. To deserve praise or blame, your actions have to be voluntary.
Really?
Meaning, they can't be forced on you by some external power, and they can't be done out of ignorance of the key facts of the situation. You have to knowingly and freely choose to do the act. If someone physically forces your hand or you didn't know the gun was loaded, well, that changes things.
Got it. And then he dedicates a whole book, book V, just to justice. He sees it as like the complete virtue.
He does, because justice is fundamentally about how we interact with others. He breaks it down pretty clearly. First, there's what he calls universal justice, which is basically just abiding by the law, being lawful.
Okay, simple enough.
But more important is particular justice, which is all about fairness in specific dealings. And this has two main subtypes. First is distributive justice. That's about the fair allocation of things like goods, honors, resources, based on merit or proportion.
Like deciding who gets the bigger office based on seniority or who gets the bonus based on performance, that kind of proportional thing.
Exactly that. The second type is corrective justice. This is about restoring balance, arithmetic equality, after some wrongdoing has occurred. Like if someone steals from you, corrective justice tries to compensate you to bring things back to how they were before the theft. It's about making things right again.
Right, balancing the scales. And judging all this correctly, distribution, correction clearly requires some serious intellectual skill, which I guess brings us to the intellectual virtues in book 6, especially the thing called phronesis, practical wisdom.
Practical wisdom, yes. For Aristotle, this is absolutely non-negotiable for a good life. It's the intellectual ability to deliberate well, to figure out what's truly good and beneficial for a human being, not just in general, but in a specific practical situation you're facing right now. And since the mean we talked about is always relative to the situation, well, you absolutely need practical wisdom to figure out the right time, the right amount, the right person, the right way to act or feel. He actually says you can't be truly morally virtuous without this intellectual skill. They go hand in hand.
And that ability to judge, to figure things out, it gets tested by, well, the reality of human failure. Which Aristotle tackles brilliantly in book 7 with this idea of weakness of will or akrasia.
Yes, akrasia. This is such an insightful piece of psychology. It's basically when a person knows the general rule or principle, like, I shouldn't eat that whole cake.
We've all been there.
Right. But at the actual moment of action, some passion or desire, like the craving for cake, it sort of overrides their ability to apply that general knowledge to the particular situation right in front of them.
So the failure isn't that they don't know cake is bad for them in general.
Exactly. It's more like a momentary lapse in rational control over the immediate desire. Their knowledge of the particular, this cake right now is bad for me, gets clouded or ignored, and it often leads to regret afterwards, of course.
Yeah, I think we've all felt acocratic when the alarm clock goes off and we hit snooze. We know getting up is the good thing for our day, but the immediate pleasure of more sleep wins out.
That's a perfect modern example. Okay, so moving on to books 8 and 9, we shift from individual psychology to social necessity, friendship, or philia. Why does Aristotle spend 2 whole books on friendship?
It seems like a lot, but he argues it's most necessary for life. Basically, you can't flourish, you can't reach eudaimonia totally alone. He identifies 3 main types of friendship. There's friendship based on utility. We're useful to each other, like business partners.
Okay.
Then there's friendship based on pleasure. We just enjoy hanging out. We have fun together.
Makes sense.
But he really stresses that only the 3rd type, virtue-based friendship, the one based on mutual admiration of each other's good character, is truly lasting and fulfilling. Why? Because it actually helps both people grow morally.
So a true friend is like a second self, he says. Someone who acts like a mirror for your own character and helps motivate you to be better.
Exactly. They see your potential and support you in reaching it. Which finally brings us to Book X, where Aristotle gives his kind of provocative conclusion about the highest form of happiness. After all this talk about action, community, virtue, where does he land?
Well, he argues that the highest, most complete form of happiness is actually the contemplative life theoria, the exercise of theoretical wisdom, pure reason, just thinking about the highest truths.
Wait, hold on.
His reasoning is that since reason is the highest, maybe even divine part of human nature, using it for this kind of intellectual contemplation is the most perfect activity we can engage in.
After stressing how important it is to be courageous in battle and generous in the city and just in our dealings, he says the best life is basically sitting alone and thinking. That sounds, I don't know, deeply impractical for most people today.
It is a bit of a surprising claim, yeah. It's provocative. But he does balance it. He acknowledges that because humans are also, you know, social, political, embodied beings, the practically virtuous life, being engaged in your community, acting morally, that remains essential and incredibly valuable. So the truly highest life probably integrates both the life of the mind and the life of good action.
Okay, that integration makes more sense. All right, let's try and distill some of this down. What are maybe 4 major themes listeners can take away and reflect on?
Okay, theme 1, we touched on it at the start. Happiness is flourishing, not just feeling good. Eudaimonia is an objective state. It's about achieving excellence in being human, not just chasing pleasant feelings.
Yeah, that really challenges us to shift our focus, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Away from just seeking instant gratification and towards actually pursuing personal excellence and living purposefully. It's about being good at being human.
Theme 2, character is built through habit. Moral virtue isn't something you're born with or something you just decide to have. It's a practical skill developed through repeated, consistent action. This really grounds ethics in our daily lives, reminding us that our character is literally built by the small choices we make over and over.
It makes ethics feel less abstract and more trainable. Theme three.
The doctrine of the mean is flexible, not rigid. It's not a simple formula. Because that mean is always relative to the person and the situation, we absolutely need that practical wisdom, that good judgment to figure out what's appropriate. It demands constant, subtle calibration, not just following a rule book.
So it requires thinking, not just obeying. Okay, and the last one.
And theme 4, ethics is fundamentally social. Our individual flourishing is inseparable from our relationships and our community. Especially important are those deep friendships. You really can't achieve your full moral potential in a vacuum. Other people are critical for our growth, our self-understanding, and our well-being.
Aristotle was also just brilliant at coining these concise, powerful lines. Let's share a few quotes or key ideas that really stick.
Okay, well, the classic definition of the goal. Happiness is an activity of soul in accordance with perfect virtue. That just nails it, doesn't it? Happiness is active. It requires effort. It's about excellence.
Yes, yeah, it sets the standard high. And then there's the one that you hear everywhere, from business coaches to self-help gurus. We are what we repeatedly do.
Yeah.
Excellence, then, is not an act, but a habit.
That one's huge. It emphasizes that consistency is what shapes us, not just, you know, one big heroic gesture. Your daily choices define you.
And maybe one that shows the difficulty of the mean.
Right. Like, anyone can become angry. That is easy. But to be angry with the right person, to the right degree, at the right time, for the right purpose, and in the right way, this is not easy. Shows that virtue isn't just having the feeling, it's having it appropriately. It requires precision.
That's a great illustration. And finally, just underlining that social connection again.
How about, without friends, no one would choose to live, though he had all other goods. That really drives home that friendship isn't just a nice extra. It's fundamental to a life worth living.
Okay, so this is all fascinating, but how do we actually use these ideas today? Let's talk practical applications. Maybe starting with personal development, using that doctrine of mean.
Yeah, you can absolutely use it as a kind of self-assessment tool.
Right.
Take an area like spending. You ask yourself, am I tending towards being wasteful, which is the excess, or am I tending towards being stingy, the deficiency, or am I hitting that sweet spot of appropriate generosity?
And once you identify where you are,
you consciously practice the actions that move you closer to that balance point. It gives you a clear target for ethical behavior rather than just vague intentions.
What about in, say, a professional setting? How does phronesis, practical wisdom, apply?
Oh, it's essential for leadership, I think. It encourages flexible, context-aware judgment instead of just rigidly sticking to the rules no matter what. A leader using practical wisdom considers the immediate tasks, sure, but also the long-term consequences, the relationships involved, the overall well-being or flourishing of the team or organization.
So it's about smarter decision-making, considering the bigger picture.
And relationships.
We can use those three types of friendship utility, pleasure, and virtue to maybe evaluate our own connections. Where are we investing our time and energy? Aristotle would urge us to consciously cultivate those virtue-based friendships, the ones built on mutual respect and aimed at mutual improvement, because those are the ones that truly sustain us and help us flourish.
It really is a philosophy of, like, intentionally building a good life brick by brick.
Absolutely. It's very active. You know, my biggest takeaway from revisiting this is just how liberating Aristotle makes ethics feel sometimes. It shifts it away from being just a list of don'ts, rules handed down from on high. Instead, he frames it as an achievable skill, something you can actually learn and get better at, like learning an instrument or a craft. The whole focus shifts from following rules to becoming a certain kind of person.
Yeah, the character-based approach.
Right. If you focus on developing good character, the idea is that the right actions will follow more naturally.
And for me, I think the lasting insight is the sheer integration of it all, how he connects reason and emotion, individual development and social connection, theoretical understanding and practical action. And that core idea of eudaimonia as something objective, something we actively build through consistent practice and making rational choices. He doesn't just tell us what the good life is. He gives us the tools to analyze ourselves and actually work towards it.
A toolkit for flourishing. It's powerful stuff, even after all this time.
Still incredibly relevant.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.